dreamer, but I'm tossing fire, leaving Babylon, trying to escape this Utah. Who child, this country jungle is too wild. That's why we got more than 2 stars. To adapt in the situation, too sharp. And though the road is rocky, I'm ready to try the next mile to bring sight to the blind man. It's down to the left child. We will survive in this country wilderness. Swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish. Jungle is specialist, predator and survivalist. Spitting heaven fire from his lips. Burning slave driver.
Welcome, listeners, to time for an awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom with all thy getting. Get an understanding. Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and catch the live stream there also. You can go to OurRadioNetwork.com. Again, that's OurRadioNetwork.com. They broadcast out of the Black Belt and catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free radio app. And then that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. And that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily by myself or Brother Richard. And do me a favor, before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook, and Time for an Awakening media is there. Always full of the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening, interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, and share with your friends. And also check out that Time for an Awakening marketplace and our partnership with the BB Toomey. Always interesting things being put in the marketplace all the time. African language classes on education, economics, social systems, health, and much, much more. So again, make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, we're scheduled to have a special guest join us, Professor Silver, Professor of History and Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies at New York University. Professor Michael A. Gomez will be joining us this evening to talk about his book, African Dominion, A New History of Empire in Early and Medieval West Africa. And we'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening at 7:13 here in the city of Philadelphia. And before we get started with our program, let me welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th. In Arch Street, Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. I'm really excited to engage in conversation with Professor Gomez this evening because, you know, that period and that he's helped us, helped me at least, explore, and his book was very, very, very helpful, you know, on a personal level and just... I guess you call it an intellectual level as far as somebody for some reason think that he belongs in Mali in the medieval period. I'm definitely happy to be able to have this conversation with him. So I'm looking forward to it.
Well, you know, on this program, Richard, we always try to feature historians, our historians, people that have done the primary research and to be able to share these things with our listening audience. To give our people an overview of not only the origins and where our people evolved and how we got to this point we are now and what we need to do to kind of bring our people back to at least a status where we once were. All of this is a puzzle that fits together, and we kind of use these men that have done the work to help us put these pieces of the puzzle together. Our guest tonight, Professor Michael A. Gomez, is a Silver Professor of History and Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies at New York University. Some of his books that he's authored in 1998, Exchanging Our Country's Marks, The Transformation of African Identities in the Colonial and Antebellum South, it was in 1998, Reversing the Sales, A History of the African Diaspora, New Approaches to African History in 2004. In 2005, The Black Crescent, The Experience and Legacy of African Muslims in the Americas. And in 2018, African Dominion, A New History of Empire in Early and Medieval West Africa. I want to welcome in our guest, Professor Michael Gomez. Professor Gomez, how are you, sir?
I'm well. Thank you so much. Thank you for your gracious introduction. I'm happy to be here this evening.
I'm glad to have you on the program on Time for an Awakening with myself and Brother Richard.
How you doing, Professor Gomez?
Brother Richard, I'm well. And yourself?
Great, great, great.
Fantastic.
And Elliot, I think I mentioned to you and Professor Gomez, since this is happening, I just so happened to be able to go to the Metropolitan Museum to see that exhibit. So hopefully at some point in our conversation, if you haven't or if you had, you maybe can shed some experience of that. It's the way it's being promoted and what it means to us here. But that aside, I just wanted to put that out there.
Very well.
Professor Gomez, before we get started with our program this evening, Brother Richard shared with me an overview of why you wrote this last book that you wrote, The African Dominion, A New History of Empire in Early and Medieval West Africa. And he cited an exchange that you had with a professor, I think when you were writing your graduate thesis. So can you kind of give us an overview of the genesis?
Oh, sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to do so. I had entered a college in the East, and I'm from Chicago, and entered a college in the East and decided to transfer back to Chicago and went to University of Chicago. I did all three degrees there. Bachelor's, master's, and the PhD there. And while I was an undergraduate, I was taking a class on Islamic civilization and decided to write a term paper, a research paper on West Africa. I knew nothing about it, and so decided that I would write this research paper on Ghana, Mali, and Songhai, and submitted the paper, and the teaching assistant, the graduate student, read the paper and gave me a C minus or a D or something, and said that the prospect of the paper, the premise of the paper was flawed, that there was nothing really to discuss, that there was really no Islamic presence in West Africa, so forth and so on. But it, for some reason, the professor of the class reread the paper. I didn't ask him to do so. He just did so on his own and decided that, in fact, I deserved an A-. But he commented that this was actually an important project. And so if I really wanted to pursue this, if I were really serious, I needed to learn Arabic, and I took him up on his challenge, and that really directed or redirected my college experience, and so I And so what I did was, just to make a long story short, I completed the bachelor's degree in U.S. history and realized that I knew nothing about Africa. And so decided to do a master's degree in African history with the intention of coming back to U.S. history, but I never made it back. I found Africa so fascinating.
We are glad.
And, yeah, and just continued with the Arabic studies all through. So that's how that developed.
Yep.
So this book, African Dominion, is heavily informed by Arabic manuscripts as well as oral tradition. And I would not have been in a position to write the book had I not studied the language.
Okay. Go ahead, Richard. Go ahead.
Yeah, because you said that, you know, it was one thing that you had in the book that I thought was interesting. And I wanted to get, what did you mean by as far as placing written external records and oral internal memory in dialogue with each other?
Yeah. So this is a very, very long history. I actually focus on the period from about the 9th century of the current era until the fall of Songhai to the Moroccans in 1591. But the history of this part of West Africa, basically the savannah and the Sahelian region, extends all the way back to at least 2000 before the Common Era. And the archaeological digs, which have been, increasing in number over the last 15 years, 20 years or so, indicate to us that, for example, in the in what is now Gao, which is the eastern, it's on what we call the Niger Buckle. The eastern to the eastern part of the Niger Buckle, in what is now Mali, contemporary Mali, that place has been occupied from at least 2000 before the Common Era. Mm-hmm. So what that means is that and Gao became the political capital of the Songhai Empire, and remained the capital of the Songhai Empire until 1591. So that place was occupied for almost 3,600 years. 3,600 years. So this is a very ancient story, but at the same time, it is a story that brings us into the modern period when we get to the 16th century. But that is a very, very, very long. The point I'm making is that we hear much about, for example, Nilotic, the Nile Valley, which we should. That's an important history. That's part of our history. We should study it. We should know it. But here is a parallel history in another part of the continent, which is almost just as long. And we are, you know, only recently beginning to learn how long it is and how significant it is. There's several urban sites in West Africa, beginning at least with 2000 before the Common Era, and by 800 BCE, there are a number of urban sites in West Africa. People smelting iron organizing cities and so forth and so on. Now, how do we know this? We know this based upon the archaeological record. And so the archaeology has really come to the fore over the last 20 years and rendered a very, very different picture of West Africa than the one that we were taught or not taught when we were younger, coming through elementary and high school and college and so forth. So this is a vast, vast history that's very, very important, and I'm trying to do my part to uncover it.
Professor Gomez, I want you to kind of walk us through some of this.
Oh, wait a minute. I want to go back to the brother's question. I have a long-winded answer, this response to the question. So when we get to the about the 9th century of the common era, of the current era, what we have at that point is we have documents that were written from outside of West Africa about West Africa. We have people who were in North Africa, people who were in Egypt, people who were in other parts of the Middle East, and they, based upon merchants' accounts and traveler accounts and so forth, they are writing about West Africa. And Al-Umari and Bekri and some of these other sources, these are people who are outside of West Africa, writing about West Africa, and they're writing at a very, very early period. So what one of the things that I'm trying to do is I'm looking at what they have to say about West Africa, and I'm looking at the internal oral record as well as to what people who were within the region had to say about their own culture and their own history, and I'm trying to put those things together. That's what I mean by placing these kinds of sources in the conversation. The sources for West Africa are complicated. There are multiple sources, very different kinds of sources coming from different parts of the region, coming emerging in different at different times, and so the challenge is to try to take all of these different types of information about West Africa, including the archaeological record, the linguistic record, and see how they all match up and what is the story that's being told. And it's quite a tapestry. It's quite a story.
Professor Gomez, the, I want to kind of, I guess for lack of a better term, start. And I don't want to start at Mali and Songhai because I saw some, accounts where you, talked about the 8th century and the kingdom that was in Ghana. And you talked about also urban areas that were very vibrant during that period that existed before. I think you mentioned about 5th or 6th century of BCE.
Right.
Give us an overview of those areas because, our people here and the knowledge that we've been exposed to a certain extent, don't give us a real history or a feel of what our areas were at that time. And when I say our areas, I'm talking about socially, politically, just a brief overview, economically and religion. Because if you have urban areas, and I think that you stated some areas might have had 25 to 40,000 people, To live in those type of environments, it has to be an order, and it has to be laws and civilization. So can you give us an overview of some of the things that you ran into as far as record-wise? I know you said it was difficult, but talk about some of those areas from your knowledge base.
Well, it was challenging, but it was very rewarding, and it's not a history that cannot be uncovered. It is a history that is, now, I'm certainly not the first person to write about Ghana, Mali, Songhai, and so forth. I'm not making that claim at all. I'm looking at what has been written in conjunction with the sources as I understand them. And I do think that this is my perspective and my conclusions are very different. One of the reasons, if I could step back, Brother Elliot, just for a second, and I'm going to get into your question, for writing this book is to make the argument that West Africa is an important site of inquiry for world history. Now, when you look at even the more contemporary, the most recent books on world history, global history, the history of empire and so forth, invariably, without fail, Africa is only mentioned briefly with respect to the Nile Valley. And even then, you have that ongoing conversation as to whether it should be considered a part of Africa. I very much consider it a part of Africa, but there are those who still refuse to see it that way. But beyond that, brief reference, there may be an allusion to something happening in West Africa prior to the colonial period, and then Africans arrive on the scene with the colonial period. So what I am really trying to address and to correct is the misinformation about Africa and about early medieval Africa. And I'm making the point that this history belongs to the world, and that we cannot understand world history without understanding West Africa as well. And in fact, West Africa from about 2,000 years ago and longer was in direct contact with other parts of the world by way of exchange of goods and services and scholarship and so forth and so on, with North Africa, with Egypt, with what becomes the Central Islamic lands and so forth and so on. So the whole point is that this early period, the world of antiquity, was aware of West Africa. They wrote about West Africa. They traded with West Africa. They were familiar with people from West Africa. It was a part of the world. And what happens is that, you know, with the colonial encounter, West Africa gets written out of that history. And we now enter it as enslaved people. And that becomes our heritage, and that becomes what we're taught. So I'm trying to combat that. Okay, with that said, we had in the very early period, that is to say, prior to written sources, prior even to oral sources, based upon the archaeological record, you had urban sites at places like Jah and Memma and Kolima and Jinno and Gao. I'm just talking about the middle Niger Valley. That's my focus.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can go beyond that. You can go deeper into the more forested areas to the south. You can go further east, further west toward the Atlantic Ocean. My focus was on the middle Niger Valley. And so you had several of these sites that I just named were of considerable antiquity. They were cities. They smelted iron. This was another thing that folks are still, scholars are still arguing about and debating. That is to say, there is no evidence that West Africans went through the process of metallurgical change. That is to say that they experimented with one metal, and then they went to another metal, and they went to another metal, and then they finally wound up smelting iron. The record demonstrates that they were smelting iron at a very, very early period. And scholars are still kind of scratching their heads as to how did they learn how to do that. But those are the facts, and these cities were well organized based upon economic endeavor with respect to various kinds of smelting and smithing and agricultural organization. Obviously, the cities were organized with respect to governance and so forth. One of the interesting things about West Africa is that, and you will see this all the way through, not just you see this in the early period, all the way through the colonial conquest, is that Africans tended to choose based upon their own, you know, kind of cultural interests, forms of government that best suited them. And what's interesting is that those forms of government could be right next to each other. Mm-hmm. But you have this variety of governance. And so what happens is that in the early period, you had the rise of city states. These are independent cities. And they eschew, they're not interested in growing territorially. They're very much interested in remaining city states, but then some things begin to develop in the 11th and 12th centuries, and we begin to see the expansion of the city state into a more of a imperial form. And it is with Sundiata in the 13th century that we see the mushrooming of the Malian Empire. So, you know, you have that situation in West Africa, but you could observe that as well in what becomes Nigeria, a little further to the east, no? Because if you look at the Yorubas in southwestern Nigeria are noted for their towns. These were townspeople, and they were independent townspeople for millennia. But right across the Niger River were the Igbo. The Igbo were village people. They were in contact with each other. They traded with each other. They knew very well about one another, but they maintained distinctive forms of governance based upon their own cultural interests. And then to the north, you have the House of Fulani, who, depending upon their period in time, were organized around city states. And then other times they had more imperial formations. But it's really very fascinating to me when you study African history, you study African people, that they had this a sense of who they were and how they wanted to organize their own lives and their own societies. And they were not necessarily interested in imposing their sense of order on other people. They were very happy to be themselves. So you know, this kind of, you know, so that's something that I want to come back to because.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, because that's a factor that we have to consider with respect to how, you know, African history unfolds. Yeah. So.
Okay.
And if I may.
Go ahead, Richard.
To you know, clarify, then how important was the Niger River to those developments? And so you mentioned the Middle Niger, but how important was that river and the riverway?
It was very important. Obviously, you know, goods and commodities and services moved up and down the river. Obviously, you could practice a kind of agriculture there, you know, that was in addition to or conjunctive with agriculture that was premised upon and dependent upon rainfall. It created a very, in essence, when you look at West Africa, the three main river systems from the savannah, from the flat grassland north into the Sahelian region, were the Senegal River, the Gambia River, and the Niger River. And, you know, the majesty of the Malian Empire, in fact, was that it was the first to encompass all three riverine systems. So it was in control of this entire system of commerce, and so it controlled the commerce from the Atlantic Ocean all the way over to, moving toward what is now northern Nigeria. It also controlled the commerce between the desert and North Africa and the forested regions to the south, and so it was quite a political construct. And one of the things that I try to do in this book is to try to understand, okay, now how was this thing organized? You know, how did people organize this government? And it was an intricate thing. You know, you had an emperor, and then you had, you know, governors, and then you had people underneath them, and you had regional officers, and you had tax collectors, and you, you know, it was a bureaucratic system, and it's all laid out in the sources. It's all laid out in the sources. This is not some of it is guesswork because some of it we don't know. We don't, for example, we don't a particular officer or office will be mentioned. We don't quite know what the office did, what the officer was in charge of.
But you know it existed.
Schema. We have a yes. We know it existed, and we have a larger schema of how the empire was organized. So it was an intricate system. So I mean, one of the things that does is very, very important is to understand that. See, because what happens with the colonial turn is that all of the African leaders become chiefs. Mm. Everybody is considered a chief or a headman, you know, and that was not. How Africans governed themselves. They had a system. They had hierarchies. They had greater and lesser powers. They had regional powers. They had powers. They had people who were responsible for specific areas, for towns, for cities, for regions, for hemispheres. It was elaborate.
Richard, go ahead.
If I may, because you know now that's one thing. Me and Ellie was going back and forth on, and I've been as I've been trying to explore this, because the time period of the social formations were so long before I'm gonna call it imposition of Islam or the development of Islam taking its role, and then European, colonialism taking its role. And I don't know if you alluded to it, but that women did have a role or a significant role in the politics of it, or is that later? I'm asking, because I'm trying to get to the belief system and that tension as the religions come.
Yes, now I understand what you're asking. And it's a twofold question. They're interrelated. So the question is one having to do with women and gender, and then the relationship to religion. Now, what we can gather from this record. Let me preface what I'm going to say by stating the obvious, and that is to say that the African continent is enormous. It is enormous, and there's tremendous diversity within that continent, all kinds of histories, all kinds of experiences, and it is not the wisest thing to generalize about Africa. That's not the wisest tactic. We have to provide for and allow for specificity. We have to allow for variation because it could be tremendous. So what I'm going to talk about now pertains to the Savannah and Sahelian parts of West Africa. What I am about to say may or may not relate to East Africa, Southern Africa, Central Africa, North Africa. Okay, so with that said, the record suggests that prior to the installation of Islam in West Africa, which really Islam is in the Sahelian region by way of merchants and scholars and so forth. Fairly early on, by the 8th century, certainly, and the numbers grow. What appears to be happening is that as West Africa becomes more integrated into an international trading network, what happens is you have a kind of movement of elites, West African elites, toward Islam, and you will have those who will convert. It appears that what happens is that prior to this period, you do have evidence of women who are in very, very powerful positions of responsibilities, leaders in their own rights, women who are in charge of city states, and at the head of the central government and so forth. It does appear that as Islam develops in the region, you begin to see a diminution of that. Now I'm not talking about the more forested areas to the south when we get to Dahomey and the Yorubas and Igbo and so forth further south, but in the savanna land, in the Sahel, there appears to be a kind of diminution of the roles of women in official political positions of power. That those roles seem to be rolled back. Now, you do have exceptions to that in northern Nigeria, in Hausaland, where you have Queen Amina and some of these other persons who were very, very powerful. They were heads of the various city states and so forth, and very famous for that. And they existed at a time when Islam was developing in northern Nigeria. But that's what I see. And in fact, you see this in the very famous epic of Sundiata, otherwise referred to as Sundiata. But the epic of Sundiata really encapsulates this transition, this transformation, because if read carefully, and the epic of Sundiata is one that was repeated over many, many years in various parts of West Africa, is very well known in the region. What you see is that in this epic, you see a transfer of power from women to men. And to some extent, I mean, one of my analyses of the epic is that it both follows this transformation or this transition of power from women to men, as well as orders it as something that should be in fact the case. It rationalizes it. So we can talk about the Epic of Sundiata because it's a very, very important oral tradition, arguably the most important oral tradition, certainly in West Africa and probably in the whole of the continent. But that's one of the things that you see is this kind of diminution, loss of power on the part of women as Islam progresses in the region. Now, the other thing that you'll find is that in Senegambia, especially in the Gambia area, the oral traditions maintain that there were a number of women who were in power in Gambia prior to the 16th century. But once again, with the development of Islam in that region, we begin to see those numbers decline, people who are in formal positions of power. So that would be my answer. Now, this is not to say that women are no longer empowered, but they're empowered in different ways. And you know, we can talk about that if you wish.
And Elliot, please, please stop me anytime, because I'm, and reading the book, because on that point, right, like, this is the book, and I want the Time for Awakening audience to really, really pursue getting this book, especially in this time, because it seems that, as you allude to, Professor, now that area for the academics and professionals, especially in industry and language and records, it seems to be more interest, and as I don't know if it's because of the manuscripts that are being developed, brought out and trying to be preserved, or well, what, but it just seems that in that area.
Well, that's a very good question. And the way I would answer it is that for some time, I would say probably from the early 80s until about now, you actually did not have a lot of scholarship on medieval West Africa. And there was the kind of standard text, Nehemiah Levzion's Ancient Ghana and Mali, which was a fine book. But there wasn't a whole lot of interest in early African history for a number of reasons. One reason for that is, this is a long-winded response, and my apologies, because I can talk on and on. But one of the reasons for that was, or is, that scholars doing African history, people who were being trained in African history, going to graduate school and so forth, became much more interested in colonialism and post-colonialism. Much, much more interested. And if you look at, over the last 20 years, if you just look at the publications in history, in African history, probably 95% of it concerns the colonial period and the post-colonial period. Mm-hmm. So that is so, and we can get into the reasons for that, but that was the situation. Now, what happens is, as you alluded to when we first began this conversation, I had a long-term interest in this project, going back to when I was an undergraduate. Now, I haven't worked on this exclusively since that time. I've been doing other things, but 10 years ago or so, I really began to focus on this project. Once again, I came back home, if you will, to this project. I had been doing other things. I worked in other parts of West Africa. I worked on the African diaspora and so forth. I have an interest in both the continent and African people outside of the continent. But what happens in the early 20th century is, the latter part of the 20th century is a development and interest in the manuscripts in Timbuktu and Gao and Jenny and so forth. And this interest will spark, a kind of new generation of people working with these manuscripts. And so I think that has something to do with certainly what is now a real interest in the history of Africa as informed by these manuscripts. With that said, this situation that took place in Timbuktu and Gao has to be one of the most significant catastrophes in the history of human beings. That is to say, when Gao and Timbuktu in particular were overrun in the early part of this century by this insurgency, it was really catastrophic, because prior to that time we were moving forward with a number of different projects in northern Mali. And I don't know if you brothers have been there or were there at the time when the operation was at its height, but we had a very, very serious series of projects with respect to these manuscripts, with respect to repairing the manuscripts, cataloging the manuscripts, photocopying the manuscripts, and so forth. And there were thousands of them. Thousands. People have no idea how many manuscripts there were. If you haven't seen these, you have no idea.
You're talking about before the period of, not the period,
before
of when
it
was burnt?
Before 2012.
I think they labeled
2012.
It Arab insurgents burned.
That's right. In 2012,
Ansar, they called them.
Muammar Gaddafi is killed, and it opens up the floodgates. And you have men and materiel coming out of Libya, going into northern Mali. connecting with a lot of dissatisfaction with the Tuareg in the region, and it was quite a mix that resulted in this insurgency that temporarily took over Timbuktu and Gao and so forth, yeah. and really did a lot of damage to the project. A number of those manuscripts, as it turns out, a number of those manuscripts were taken into Bamako in the southern part of Mali. Others remain in Timbuktu. It appears that a small percentage were destroyed. My sense is that we still don't know. I think that a number of these manuscripts will turn up in auctions and so forth decades from now. And so, you know, we just have to wait and see.
You know, what I got excited about, besides the manuscripts themselves, was because this is not the first time, and if I understand it right, in the history of these manuscripts and the onslaught of the Islamic incursions in Timbuktu, that these manuscripts being handled by families. You know, what excited me, correct me if I'm wrong, where families were responsible for keeping them and keeping them secret because of the fear. I mean, this is going from the medieval period, you know, on, but they you know, being able to have it. And then now they were getting ready to come. Families were, you know, turning them over in South Africa, getting involved. And then this here incursions occur where there's, you know, the attempt to try to destroy them. One, am I correct about that as far as the families were the librarians of these manuscripts and they were under family control?
You're absolutely right about that.
Wow.
You're absolutely right about that. So families, these are treasures. These are treasures. And the families understand how valuable these records are. It's interesting, no? It's interesting because it contradicts everything that the West has to say about Africans.
Exactly.
About what we regard to be important, you know, what we value. But families held on to these manuscripts. They hid them from colonial officers. They would bury them in the sand, so forth and so on, in metal cases and so forth. And they held on to these manuscripts. And it was toward the end of the 20th century that they began to release them because they felt that they would be safe. Timbuktu was becoming this place, right, where a lot of significant amount of money was being funneled into the city for the purpose of taking care of these manuscripts. And so the family said, oh, you know, maybe some of these things can come to light now.
Yes.
And as a matter of fact, there were, if I'm not mistaken, about 22 private family archival deposits or repositories in Timbuktu. This is in addition to the Ahmed Baba Library. The Ahmed Baba Library was owned by the state. So you had thousands of manuscripts already there. But then you had, you know, I think at least 22 families that also maintained their own repositories. And you could go and you could petition to see these manuscripts in these individual places. Now, in Djenne, as opposed to Timbuktu, in Djenne, the families had agreed to release their manuscripts, and they were going to be put into a central library right across from the central mosque.
Mm-hmm.
And that process was developing at the point when disaster struck in 2012. So some of that work is still going on in Bamako, but it's
the process was very much arrested in 2012. As you know, northern Mali is still very dangerous. And so it'll be some time before those manuscripts can be returned to northern Mali. Yeah.
Professor Gomez, let me go back a little bit, because it's something you said earlier that you wanted to touch base back on, and maybe this conversation will bring you back to that area. The reason I wanted you to start from the Kingdom of Ghana and some of the urban areas that you talked about prior to is because that was before Islam really started sweeping across Eastern, Northern, and Western Africa. Richard mentioned about women being prominent in positions of power, and you said that kind of started to change when Islam became more prevalent. Talk about, because we can see that in Mali and Songhai, that Islam was there. It was entrenched. The leaders was Islamic. But talk about the people's response to it, as far as what you've seen, evidence-wise. We can see that it was old cultures and old ways of governing themselves. You talked about some of the ways that the people govern themselves, and we know that that changed. Talk about the people's response to that and how they fought back in ways that might not be known to us.
This is Brother Elliot asking the question.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yeah, this is a difficult thing. I'm going to tell you why it's a difficult thing. It's a difficult thing because, that is to say, to know. I think you're right. I mean, I meant to address this because you did bring it up earlier. That is the question of religion. Prior to the movement of Islam into the region, it's very difficult to talk about that because we just don't know a lot about it. One of the reasons why we don't know a lot about it is because, as a consequence of the Islamization of the society, what happens is that over a period of time, a lot of what was there before gets erased.
Okay. All right.
Me and Richard were talking about that. So it's very difficult to know. So, for example, with respect to Ghana, with respect to ancient Ghana, and so once again, for your listeners, I'm sure they know this, but just to make sure that we're all on the same page, ancient Ghana was located in what is now southern Mauritania. That was ancient Ghana. The contemporary state of Ghana, if we get on a plane and get off at Accra, that was not ancient Ghana. Kwame Nkrumah decided to change the name of Gold Coast to Ghana with independence. Ancient Ghana was in what is now southern Mauritania, and it was the state was inhabited by the Soninke, and the Soninke are a Mande speaking people, and one of the accounts that purports to described the fall of Ghana was that there was this snake called Bidda, and the snake was worshipped, and every year the snake required the sacrifice of a young maiden, and that one year the young maiden had a suitor who did not want to see the maiden sacrificed to the snake, and so he chopped off the head of Bidda, and the head fell from it tumbled all the way down into an area called Bouré, which is close to contemporary Ghana. And but the snake was located in an area called Bambouk. Now, Bambouk was the source of Ghana's gold. That's where gold was being mined. And so Bouré would become a new source of gold. And so the account tries to represent the transfer of the focus of gold mining. Bambouk would always continue to produce gold, but Bouré became another important source subsequently. So the account the story tries to account for this movement of gold mining from Bambouk in the north to Bouré to the south. But what's interesting there is this notion that the snake was worshipped. We don't know a whole lot more about that. We have a description, for example, of ancient Ghana, the way the city was laid out. And we know that there were sacred groves where the ruler lived and where the religious practitioners lived. There seemed to be a very close affinity between the ruler and the religious specialists. But we don't know a whole lot about the religion other than this, you know, this reference to this snake. And what we do know is that ancient Ghana prior to the 11th century was non-Muslim. It was not a Muslim state. It's in the 11th century and afterward that there's this conversion. Now, I'm glad you asked about this question, this matter of Islam. So it would appear that by the end of the 15th century, all of the major states along the savannah, from Mali to Songhai to Kanem-Bornu in the Lake Chad area, all of the rulers in Hausalen, Kano, Katsina, so forth, all of the rulers of these major polities were Muslim.
Okay.
They were all Muslim.
Yes.
Now, that does not mean that their constituencies were Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And it appears that how can I put this? It appears that a significant number probably were not Muslim, A, and B, that the rulers were fine with that. That is to say that they were not necessarily invested in trying to convert their people. And this is interesting because it will lead to complications in the 18th and 19th centuries. But earlier on, it appears that there were probably significant populations within these states or kingdoms that, A, were not Muslim, and B, there were very few attempts to try to convert them to Islam. And so there was a relationship there. There was a kind of, one can say, a kind of tolerant form of Islam that allowed for people to coexist. That would appear to have been the case. Now, that's to some extent based upon speculation. We don't quite know exactly, but that would appear to be the case. The possible exception to that, Brother Elliot, were the people of Mali. The people of Mali were renowned for being Muslim. They are renowned for being the first West African population to have been thoroughly Muslim. And we could have some conversation about that as to what that might mean, but they had that reputation. That's the point. They had that reputation of being Muslim far and wide. And so that is something that other West African populations may or may not have they may or may not have been associated with Islam in that way. But the people of Mali, what was referred to as Mandan, Old Mali, were thoroughly identified with Islam.
Now that was Mansa Musa's kingdom.
That was Musa's empire, and you know that goes back to So the Keita clan, the royal clan. You know, if you go through their genealogy, they claim to be descendants of Bilal ibn Rabah, the first person who called the Muslims to prayer. And so that claim, whether the claim is truthful or not, the claim itself, you know, suggests that, you know, this that Islam was very important in this, you know, to the Malian people, and it's been around there for a long, long time.
Let me ask this one more thing, Rich, and then you can kind of jump in, and help me with this because. You know, the class is in session now, so yeah, we're listening to you. Now, we can see that the period that you're focusing in on, medieval and early West Africa, is almost a nexus of things that's going to change world events from that period to maybe the next 500 years.
That's right.
Now, let me, and the reason I mentioned that about starting with Ghana and some of the indigenous things going on there and things started to change is that some of the things that was very intricate to what was going to happen within the next two, maybe 300 years, depending on what period that we're talking about, is Richard touched on women being kind of pushed to the rear as far as in positions of power. Also, the slavery aspect of it. And when I say slavery, I'm talking about the human trafficking. It's clear from world history that different people at different times had indentured servants or things of that nature. But the human trafficking really started to come to the fore to where when the Europeans came down there, it was almost like a let's get involved type of thing. But talk about that as far as when Islam and individuals started to really take power in certain areas of African countries, and I don't know whether it was they wanted to impose their will or wanted to smash indigenous beliefs or just smash people that didn't agree with them to the point where human trafficking started to evolve.
That's a great question. It's a complicated question. You have to give me a minute to kind of unpack that.
Okay.
So the first thing we want to recognize is that, for example, I was talking about by the end of the 15th century, all of these city states and or centralized states or empires, depending upon what we're talking about, they were all led by Muslims. They were not all similarly involved in slaving activity. They were not the same.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, with respect to Imperial Mali, from the period of Sundiata in the 13th century, and Mali will exist all the way into the 17th century. It will be eclipsed by Songhai, but it's still around. And as a matter of fact, a number of the Africans who come into the New World have some relationship to Mali, some of them. So,
Richard.
And the memory of that continues on into the New World. So Mali, in my estimation, and people can disagree with me, but in my estimation, Mali was the most significant West African polity or state or empire to have existed. It was truly a magnificent development without question. Now, but they were not necessarily involved in significant trafficking in human beings. There was probably some through the Sahara, but Mali was not known as a major source of enslaved persons. Mali was known as the land of gold.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, that was the phrase, Mali, the land of gold. And so now there was domestic slavery within Mali, and to the extent of which is really not clear. Further to the east, in the Lake Chad area, you did have quite a lot of trafficking in human beings from the Lake Chad area north into Libya. That, and as a matter of fact, the Kanem-Bornu area was known for that. That's what they were known for.
Okay.
So it depends upon where you were in West Africa. All right. And it's difficult to know. This is my position, and people can disagree with me, and there are those who do disagree with me. But my sense is that, based upon what I'm seeing, my sense is that there may have been, in fact, there was domestic enslavement. There was domestic slavery in parts of West Africa, not necessarily all of West Africa, prior to the 15th century and the Portuguese beginning to come down the West African coast. You did have some domestic slavery in some parts of West Africa. The extent to which you had it is an open question. Depends upon what society you're talking about. My sense is that it was not highly developed.
Okay.
My sense is that it becomes much more developed with the transatlantic trade, and as well as the further development of the trans-Saharan trade. Now, you have scholars, for example, who will write about African history, and they get to the topic of slavery, and they will say slavery is as old as Africa. Based upon what? I mean, how do you know that? So one of the most important historians of West Africa was Walter Rodney. Walter Rodney wrote A History of the Upper Guinea Coast. If you go back and you look at Brother Rodney, what Walter wrote, what Walter says is that in his study, he saw very little evidence, okay, for the existence of domestic slavery prior to the transatlantic trade. And that's what Walter Rodney wrote.
Well, that's why I asked that question. I wanted you, from your research.
Yes, I'm getting into it now.
Okay.
I'm getting into it now.
Okay.
All right. So my position is that, with the growth of the transatlantic trade, it stimulates trafficking within West Africa. It stimulates it.
Okay.
So people respond. They respond in different ways.
Okay.
They respond in different ways. Most people are trying to get away from it. But you are always going to have people who will try to benefit from it.
Yes.
You're going to have that. And so you have persons who will engage with Europeans on the coast for the purpose of procuring human beings. And this thing really begins to take off, because Africans were, those who were involved in the trading would import textiles for the most part. And textiles were always being imported in exchange for human beings and other things. Other goods. But what happens is that when we move into the 18th and the 19th century, when the trade really gets heavy, what Europeans begin to bring to the coast are firearms. They are importing, they are bringing firearms into West Africa, West Central Africa.
Effective.
And they are doing that for the express purpose of accelerating the transatlantic trade in human beings. So textiles will always be in that exchange, but you see a significant increase in the number of firearms. And what Europeans will do, they will always, of course, keep the latest weaponry. They're not going to trade that to Africans, but they will bring defunct weaponry, or weapons that they no longer use, for example, muskets and so forth. They'll bring that to the coast. what that will do is to stimulate that trade. Of that, there is absolutely no question. So that's my position. And so what happens is, as that stimulates the trade, it leads to all kinds of repercussions within West Africa. So you have people who are participating in this trade. They're going out raiding. Wars are being encouraged precisely for the purpose of either protecting communities from slaving or to produce people to sell into the trade. And so it becomes a horrific thing. That is also augmented by the trade across the Sahara.
Hmm.
So you have Africans leaving the continent by the ton. And it is an awful, awful situation. Now, we know about that. With respect to Islam, I want to say this. It's important to underscore this. You do have slavery. Islam is huge. It is an enormous development. It reaches all the way from what is now Spain and Portugal all the way to China and Indonesia. It's a huge development. The vast majority of people who are enslaved in the Muslim world are Europeans and Asians.
Mm-hmm.
Up until the 18th century. In the 18th century, some things begin to happen, and then the majority of the people who are enslaved are Africans. We can get into that, but that's a long story. But so the thing about slavery in the Islamic world is that it was not racialized. If you could be enslaved, and if that's the way it went, and you were enslaved, then that's what happened. But it was not a thing that was based upon the fact that you were black or green or brown or yellow. It all had to do with your status and whether you were Muslim or not Muslim, and that's another story.
Okay.
But the point is that up until the 18th century, the majority of the people who were enslaved in the Muslim world were not Africans. They were non-Africans. They were people from the Russian steppe, what is now Eastern Europe, and all kinds of Asian populations and so forth. That's what that deal was. That is in contrast to what we see developing in the Americas. In the Americas, slavery was highly racialized. It was all based upon the African. Yeah, you had some Native Americans who were enslaved and some white indentured servants, but for the most part, the vast majority of the people were African. Okay. So it's a real contrast in slavery systems. Now, with respect to, well, you mentioned Mansa Musa. You know, there are those who maintain that Mansa Musa was the wealthiest person, not just black person, but the wealthiest person who ever lived.
Mm-hmm.
That may very well be the case. I would not contest that. But this is the thing. Mali was a wealthy empire. And when Mansa Musa makes pilgrimage and he goes to Egypt, he brings so much gold with him until the value of gold depreciates for years and years. He brings, by my calculation, about 18 tons of gold into Egypt. That's a lot of gold for that period of time. And
wait a minute, so how did he move all that gold?
People.
Mm-hmm.
He had people moving that gold. And they were, most of them were domestic slaves.
Wow. Okay, go ahead.
He had an entourage. He had an entourage of thousands and thousands of people, depending upon the source. Thousands. This was a pilgrimage unlike any other. It has never been matched in human history.
And if I may, Dr. Gomez, I want to give you your props, because I think from the little bit I probably have seen, you have developed that moment and that movement and the back and the forth that more than anybody I've seen. And, you know, so I just wanted to say that because there's a lot of intricacies, politics and other things that went on that you describe. And I, again, it's a testament for why people of Time for Awakening should get your book.
Well, yes, sir. I appreciate that. Okay, so now, so I told you I could talk. So now, let me get to the heart of the matter. And this is the heart of the matter. When Mansa Musa has the wealth and displays it, right? This is the problem that I state in the book. The problem is that Mansa Musa is about 20, 30, 40 years too early to have all of that wealth. Why do I say that? Because when Mansa Musa, this is early 14th century, when he is moving through the period, through the world with all of this wealth, the state of weaponry and the technology, okay, was in Mali was not very different from what it was in Egypt. When he goes to Egypt, Egypt was at the center of the what we call the Sunni Orthodox Muslim world. They were the ones who had defeated the Mongols, the Mamluk rulers. They had defeated the Mongols, and because the Mongols had taken Baghdad in 1258 and so on, it was the Mamluks in Egypt who stopped them.
Okay.
Now, what did the Mamluks have? They were archers. Okay, they had bows and arrows. That's what they had. And they had chain mail. Well, guess what? Mali had the same thing. So when Mansa Musa goes to Egypt, technologically he doesn't see anything very different from what he has in his own kingdom. Why is he about 40 years too soon? Because after Mansa Musa dies, about 40 years later, we enter into the realm of gunpowder weapons. And that is what makes the difference. When Europeans get their hands on gunpowder weapons and they begin to develop those weapons are what make the difference. In West Africa, West Central Africa, South Africa, the American West.
The world, yeah.
The world. That is what makes the difference. And so that's why I say that Mansa Musa was a little ahead of his time, because had he come a little later, even if they weren't developing the technology in West Africa, he could have purchased it.
Mm.
Maybe you and I would be over in the continent someplace having a very, very different conversation.
Now let me ask you a question before I let Richard, because I know, Richard, you chopping at the bit. Let's go back and look at that, Professor Gomez.
Yes.
You mentioned that Mansa Musa's weapons wasn't much different than what he saw in Egypt.
That's right.
Now, gunpowder came along and other nations. Now, you correct me if I'm wrong. I don't know. I'm a more than an amateur historian. From what I understand, Asians or Chinese kind of developed the use of gunpowder for other reasons.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. Now you had one society that was in Asia that was already using gunpowder.
Right.
The Europeans, who were a different type of people, were warlike and always used to fighting. I mean, bloody battles. So when were their mindset different when they came to say, wow, we can develop a weapon? Because other cultures were exposed to gunpowder and they didn't try to develop a weapon that would vanquish other people.
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think that I'm going to choose to answer that question in a certain way.
Okay, I understand.
And this is the way I want to answer it. The acquisition of gunpowder and the development of gunpowder weapons in Europe will take place at the same time that Europe is developing different naval vessels.
Okay.
Seafaring vessels. And this also becomes critical. So what Europe can do in the Mediterranean, as well as the Black Sea, is they can experiment with different types of sea craft, different types of vessels. And they can begin to develop vessels that can sail, because the Mediterranean, as you know, and the Black Sea have significant bodies of water. So they can develop vessels that can go on these very, very long voyages. And so it takes them hundreds and hundreds of years to develop these vessels. And they also do so as a consequence of being informed by, influenced by developments in the Indian Ocean. What do I mean by that? When the Muslims come into what is now Senegal, when they come into Spain and Portugal in 711, they will also bring with them from, and they're from there, they are in the Iberian Peninsula from 711 to 1492, so almost 800 years. During the time that they are there, that they are, the Muslims are in Iberia, they are bringing with them the knowledge systems that are developed all across the Muslim world, including the knowledge of seafaring, the knowledge of seafaring in the Indian Ocean. That is an ancient knowledge, people in the Indian subcontinent, Arabs, and East Africans all practiced. And so they brought, for example, the lateen sail. They brought with them knowledge of tacking. Europe didn't know anything about that. So when Europe began to learn about the lateen sail and tacking and so forth and so on, they were able to experiment with long boats, short boats, this and that, and they were finally able to develop craft that could slowly circumnavigate the West African coast. Mali was landlocked. Mali was a land power. So what's happening is this is the frustration about it, is because with Mali and Songhai, these were the two most powerful West African states to have existed. But they're coming along, they're both landlocked. Neither one of them are able to develop those kinds of vessels. So they are stuck. The only way that they can move to and reach the other parts of the world is through the Sahara. That's the only route they have. So in the 15th century, by the 15th century, Europe has the jump because they have the vessels. They are experimenting with gunpowder weapons. The most powerful West African states to have existed are landlocked. They do not have access to gunpowder weapons. They do not have access to vessels that can navigate the seas. And so they are at a decided, West Africa, West Central Africa, the whole of Sub-Saharan Africa is at a decided disadvantage. This is my opinion. Because what happens is this. People will say, oh, no, Africans were at a similar kind of technological level and so forth and so on. That's just not true. And not only is that not true, but what happens is a relationship develops between Africa and Europe that to this day has yet to be arrested. That relationship is one in which Africa provides raw materials for finished products. It begins with the slave trade. When the slave trade ends in the 19th century, it moves to palm kernels and palm oil and rubber and this, that, and the other. And so people go on and on about how rich the African continent is. Yes, this is true. In raw materials, Africa is extremely rich. There is nothing Europe has in terms of just, you know, raw materials. But what Europe does is that it takes those raw materials back to Europe and finishes those products and then sells them back to Africa, back to Asia, or so forth and so on. So this whole industrial thing gets kicked off in Europe. it does not get kicked off in Africa. And so this, in my humble opinion, I think this remains a major, major issue. Okay, you can have uranium deposits and gold and all kinds of things underneath your soil. The question is, who's developing it? Where is it being finished? Because that's where the money is. Now, you take a look, for example, I mean, the exception to this, obviously, is Saudi Arabia and the Gulf nations and oil. That's a big exception because that's a primary commodity that, you know, has resulted in enormous wealth in the Gulf. Okay, but a lot of African states, Ghana, you have oil coming offshore, oil in Ghana that's been around now for 10 years or so. Of course, Nigeria has been producing oil for a long, long time, but for reasons that we may not want to get into, it has not resulted in the uplifting of the nation as a whole. And but this whole thing, for example, with respect to Senegal, I love Senegal. That's where I did my initial research in West Africa. Lived there in the eastern part of Senegal. But you cannot have an economy literally based upon groundnuts, the production of groundnuts, okay, and expect to compete with Western Europe. It's just not going to. But that's the relationship that the continent has developed with the so-called developed world, and you know, we have to raise questions. Why don't you see multinational corporations investing in Africa in the way that they invest in Latin America, in the way that they invest in Asia and so forth? There are reasons for that we can talk about or not, but this is the thing. So you know, if Mansa Musa had come along maybe 50 years later, you know, things might be a whole lot different.
And I appreciate you saying that. And it sparks, and I think I'm going to, if you don't mind, going to want to, because the question comes about Mansa Musa and gold and Europe. And then the other part about, during the medieval period, especially the transportation modes, and I'm thinking of camels and horses. We had a discussion yesterday as far as when they're introduced, and it seems to be going into different directions in relationship to trade. So my question about Mansa Musa and the gold, would it be correct to say that Europe really didn't know how much gold existed until Mansa Musa made that pilgrimage?
They didn't know much of, yes, that is correct. That is to say that Europe did not, Europe was, so the vast majority of the gold that is minted in Europe during the medieval period is West African gold. The Europeans do not necessarily know the source of that gold. They're trading for that gold in North Africa. The Tuareg are bringing that gold up from West Africa to North Africa, and then they're trading that gold into Europe. All right. To a lesser extent, the gold is coming out of Nubia and so forth, but for the most part, that's West African gold. So they have a sense of that. But when Mansa Musa makes his pilgrimage, it makes a big splash, and the whole world becomes aware of the fact that you have this fabulous ruler, you know, in West Africa, and he's sitting on top of all this gold. And of course, Europe becomes very, very interested in that. I mean, that's one of the reasons why that's one of the things that stimulates their interest in developing this long distance trade and developing the sea craft there are two things they're trying to do. Primarily, they're trying to access the Indian Ocean. They do not want to go through the Muslim middlemen. They don't want to go through Saudi Arabia. They don't want to go through Egypt. They want to go straight to the Indian Ocean. That's what Christopher Columbus called himself doing. They were trying to get straight to the Indian Ocean. so that they could access that trade and control that trade. But secondarily, they were interested in West African gold.
And the other question that goes to Trent, you know, when we was looking at going through the exhibit yesterday at the Met, you know, one of the terracotta pieces was about horses. And the question that also came up about camels. When did and I think camels will be first. When was camels introduced into West Africa? And was that for west to east trade? And when was horses introduced in Africa, West Africa, in that the savannah era? And was that for north to south to north trade?
Ooh. Yeah, those are excellent questions. With respect, let's talk about the camel. The estimation is that camels were introduced into the Sahara somewhere between 100 BC and 100 AD or 100 of the Common Era. So that around that time you have the introduction of camels, and those are for the purpose of transporting commodities from North Africa to West Africa and back. So camels are basically, you know, used, you know, in the desert areas and, you know, to facilitate a commerce exchange between North Africa and West Africa. So you always had trade going all the way back to the Romans, to the ancient Romans. You had trade between West Africa and the Mediterranean. And the people that were referred to, the Roman sources refer to the people moving commodities through the desert as the Garamans. This is probably a reference to the Tuareg. But this was a much slower process. They didn't have any camels at that time. But when the camel is introduced, it really speeds up this commerce and really facilitates the commerce. And so things really, really explode. So that's what camels were for. With respect to the horses, horses are introduced to West Africa and specifically the Middle Niger between the 7th and the 10th centuries. This is a later development, and once they are introduced into now to be fair. Horses were already in Ghana prior to the 7th century. It's not clear precisely when they are introduced into Ghana. But what happens is that in the Middle Niger, they are introduced between the 7th and the 10th centuries. And now the horse then becomes, becomes the basis of the cavalry. So what happens is that horses are bred in West Africa, and so they represent a whole new technology. Mm. And cavalry become very, very important in West Africa. The armies of Mali and Songhai are all, they had the infantry, but they were premised on the cavalry. And when you read the sources, when you read the Arabic sources, they refer to chainmail. So this was just a magnificent thing. I mean, you had these soldiers mounted on these horses with these long lances and in chain mail, and the horses were protected with chain. I mean, you had all of this going on.
And so the iron became a really significant for that cavalry as far as creating armament and, you know, the armory for the cavalry. So, you know, you had mentioned earlier about, you know, iron smelting you know, the technology going back to before the Christian era, you know, and here it's being in the medieval area, it's still being utilized, and the army, the military is utilizing, or the cavalry is utilizing.
Yes. Yes, this is the thing. I mean, so the iron is being used for all sorts of purposes, but you know, folks are using chainmail and so forth. They have some very serious weapons, you know, and they can protect themselves. But the depiction of when the Moroccans come through the desert and they attack the Songhai, we have very, very vivid depictions of what happens. And what happens is that the Songhai have never seen firearms. Mm. They are unfamiliar with the sound. They certainly with the devastation that these weapons can produce. You know, but they do their best. And one of the most memorable depictions is that the Songhai, they don't run. They don't run. The depiction is that the Songhai, the archers, you know what they do? They kneel in a shooting position and they tie their legs together so that they're not going anywhere. And they make their stand. But those firearms are devastating. The firearms are devastating. And when it's the firearm that really tells that when you read the history of the colonial experience, it's the firearm that really turns the tide, because
yes.
when the French begin to travel up the Senegal River trying to establish their authority in the 19th century, in the early 19th century, they send gunboats. And the people have never seen anything like that before. They've just never seen anything like that before. And they just cannot withstand that kind of firepower. And when the Zulu and the Xhosa are fighting Europeans in South Africa, okay, what they call the Wars of Dispossession from around 1770s to the 1870s. What turns the tide in that fight is the unleashing of the Gatling gun. The Gatling gun is unleashed on South Africans at the same time that it's unleashed on Native Americans in the West.
Okay. Oh, I didn't see the parallel between the two. Yeah. Wow.
Yes, and the Gatling gun, you know, as you know, is the forerunner to the machine gun.
Yeah, right.
And it's just absolutely devastating.
We got about 10 minutes
left. So it's not a situation where, you know, our people were afraid. It's not a situation where our people didn't fight. It's a situation where the technology was just too much.
That movie, and I don't know if it's always outgunned.
Right.
In this case, it was outgunned.
Yes.
That created the, the historical moment we're still addressing now.
We're still addressing. There were disparities there, but so that's the situation. I'm sorry, sir. You were saying?
No. I was just going to say we got about 9 minutes left in the program before we're going to break this evening. Before we go, Professor Gomez, I want you to touch on something that you and Mansa Musa said that kind of leaves you scratching your head. But Richard, what's his name? The historian, he just flew out of my head, that talked about us being here prior to Richard, come on.
Ivan Van Sertima.
Yeah. That's something that Ivan Van Sertima and Mansa Musa said that might leave you scratching your head, Professor Gomez. You mentioned in a video clip that when in the entourage in the parade, when Mansa Musa came into Cairo, that he expressed to them that, you know, we got a lot of things, and I'm just paraphrasing, we got a lot of things going on. We got people that have voyaged to a new world talking about over here. And they're not with us right now. They'll be here shortly, or they'll be back. And Ivan Van Sertima talks about it, but it kind of left you scratching your head because you said you didn't see the primary evidence. Talk about that before we kind of wind things down.
Yeah, so I'm happy that you raised that. And if I'm allowed to write a revision of African Dominion, I want to kind of slightly tweak that part a little bit, because I think that you know, I have had some folk coming after me about that. So this is an
opportunity serious that just now. They are
serious about it. I want people to understand what I'm saying. I'm not saying that they didn't have. I'm not saying that. So what happens is this. Mansa Musa is in Cairo. They ask him, how did you come to power? Mansa Musa says, okay, this is how I came to power. There was a ruler before me. He decided he wanted to sail to the west. And he took 1,000 ships with, they prepared, took 1,000 ships, and went out. They sailed out west. They sailed into the great ocean. And sometime later, only one person came back and said, everybody got lost. We were traveling, and we hit this stream in the middle of the ocean, and it took us all away. And I'm the only person who survived that. And so Mansa Musa says, okay, so then what happens is his successor decides to embark upon the same voyage, and he undertakes the voyage, but he doesn't come back, and so that's how I became ruler. Now, what I'm looking at is what fascinates me is not necessarily the issue of whether they made the voyage. I do try to address that. And they may well have made the voyage. And in fact, I make the point that the fact that that this man comes back and says that they encountered this stream, you know, in the ocean, suggest that indeed they did make the voyage, because there's no other way for him to have known that this stream is something that is way out in the ocean, and
so it does exist. It does exist.
Oh, it definitely exists.
Okay,
it definitely exists. I have a whole section where I talk about it, the name of the stream, it'll come back to me. It's the Canary Current. Yes, it is the Canary Current. It exists. So you have to venture far off of the West African coast to engage it, to encounter it. This current flows from basically Europe down the West African coast, and then it turns and it goes toward the Gulf of Mexico, and that's the Gulf Stream, and then it goes back across the Atlantic toward Europe and North and West Africa. So the southern part of that current is known as the Canary Current. That's real. And it's about 1,000 kilometers in width. That's a very, very broad stream. So the thing is, the stream could have very well taken them into the New World, but they could not get back. They could not get back because the stream, the Canary Current is very, very powerful. It would not bring them back to West Africa. It would, if anything, it would bring them to Europe. So it's possible that they made that voyage. As a matter of fact, I do believe that they probably made that voyage. The accounts themselves, they don't claim that anybody came back except for that one individual. So the accounts are not claiming that people came back. So it's very possible that they made, and especially I've been looking at the voyages in Polynesia and so forth and so on, and how people basically, the people in Polynesia, they have basically, they basically have the same kinds of technology as West Africans. And they went for long trips from island to island to island and populated those islands. So it's very, very possible that that took place. But the thing that I am interested in is the relationship of that story to Musa coming to power. And Mansa Musa, there's another story that really intrigues me, and it has to do with it has to do with matricide. Apparently, either Mansa's own mother or a mother of a sibling or an aunt or a grandmother, somebody was accidentally killed in the process of him coming to power. And this raises the question as to what was really going on. Mansa Musa didn't tell that story in Cairo. He didn't talk about this royal female figure being killed. He didn't see that story. That story is told in West Africa, in the chronicles.
Okay.
So what I try to do in the chapter is try to raise questions as to what this could possibly mean. And it could mean that Mansa Musa was not the rightful heir, or it could mean that either his own mother or a mother of a sibling or an aunt or grandmother was accidentally killed. But when the woman is accidentally killed, what happens is Mansa Musa goes to the scholars and says, "This I accidentally killed this woman. What can I do to make amends?" And they tell him, "You need to go on pilgrimage. You need to make the pilgrimage." So that's the genesis of that pilgrimage, this story of this woman being killed. And that woman may have been a regent, going back to the question of women in power. She may have been in power. She may have been in power and was somehow overthrown. So it's really unclear. It's really, really unclear. One other story about a woman who contested power concerns Mansa Musa's successor, Mansa Suleiman, later on in the 14th century. That's his brother. That's Musa's brother. And Mansa Suleiman weds another wife and puts the existing wife takes offense. And she's put in a kind of jail situation. And when she's released, she leads an insurgency. And it appears that she's on the verge of contesting power. Now, the only reason we know this is because there happened to be a visitor in the royal city at that time, Ibn Battuta. Ibn Battuta was there, and he gives us an eyewitness account of all of this. So there's a lot going on in Mali and in Songhai. Just some wonderful, wonderful accounts and wonderful, wonderful stories of these early rulers. But make no mistake about it, Mansa Musa saw himself as a peer. He saw himself as a peer of the Egyptian rulers. He saw himself as a peer of the North African rulers. And he wanted to make his mark. And I think the landlocked nature of Mali will prevent him from you know, from being able to do that to the extent that he wanted. Yeah.
Professor Gomez, I want to thank you for being able to share with us this evening. I guess the class is about over about now. So,
well, I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you for inviting me. I feel like we were just getting started. There's so much more to talk about.
And Elliot, I want to make sure, you know, because, you know, I feel like I belong in Mali, and this history isn't necessary for me to really be myself, but I'll go there for another time, you know, dealing with that. But I definitely would like you to develop, because that period is to us.
Wait a minute. Repeat that, Richard. You kind of broke off.
I said that period is so important to us because the medieval period gives demonstration that all they said about Africans not knowing is not true.
Definitely. It is as James Baldwin wrote, you know, he said, and I'm paraphrasing him. He says, we have been lied to for so long. Been lied to for so long. And, but the evidence is before us, you know, and, you know, hopefully we will be able to get, you know, more and more into this. Because when you, and this is the thing, I mean, when I teach undergraduates African diasporic history, and, you know, it is so wrong to tell these young people that black folk started in slavery, that that's our beginning. That is so disempowering, and it is so inaccurate, and it is just a bold-faced lie. And when our young people begin to see, oh, it was like that? You mean we had kingdoms? You mean we had hierarchies? You mean we had, you know, we had governance? You mean we had, you know, we had smithing? You mean we had cities and towns and commerce, and people were moving around in peace? You know, in an empire that stretched the whole of Western Europe. It really changes the dynamics, and this is something that we need to more fully explore.
You know, we got to get you back on here sometime soon, because I want you to kind of go into the real social, political, and economic dynamics of a lot of the ancient civilizations of West Africa.
Yeah.
Because it'll give us, our people, a perspective of, you know, listen, we've been here in the United States basically since we've been brought over here, and we're exposed to policing, the democratic, republican forms of government, a lot of different things, and we know nothing other than this. I think it's important for our historians, yourself and others, to give us a perspective of what our people did prior to this. And it goes to what you just said. It gives our people a whole new outlook and respect of themselves and things they can pass down to their you know, progenitors, their young people.
That's right. And the last point I'll make, and I tell my African colleagues, I tell my African students, this is my history. This is your history, but this is just as much my history as it is your history. Because in the 14th, 15th centuries, we were all there. We were all there. So this is my history as much as it is your history.
I want to thank you for being with us, and we'll be tell me, is there something coming out soon? You have another book or something coming out soon?
No, man, I just got this one out, and, you know, so the next one will be, you know, it's in formation, so it'll be a little while. Oh, but the reversing sale, I finished the second edition of that, if people want to take a look at that. So that came out recently. It's a second edition, so I added quite a bit to reversing sale.
Give out any information where the people can purchase your book, whether you want them to go straight to your website or Amazon. I don't know.
Go to Amazon. You know, they can go to Amazon. Reversing Sale It's published by Cambridge University Press, and it you know, they can go straight to Amazon. The first edition is available, but I would suggest the second edition. And it's a black cover with a sister on the front, and it's hard to miss.
Professor Gomez, thanks for being with us, and we'll talk to you soon.
You're more than welcome. You all have a good evening.
You too,
God
sir.
God bless you.
All right. Thank you. Peace.
Bye.
Richard, interesting discussion, man. It gives us some insight on some of the things going on during that period. I like some of the things that he mentioned in regards to the way our people govern themselves then.
Definitely.
And what did he say? Because I wrote it down. They were happy to be themselves in their respective city-states. They didn't impose their will on one another, and they respected each other. So that, you know, that you know, it's not that we lived in a panacea back then. You know, people were people. But it gives a different perspective on how we viewed ourselves and the world at that time.
And, you know, and the way for those of us who are looking at new forms of self-governance in this moment, when you're talking about creating a social organization where people are at relatively at peace with themselves, don't need to expand, don't need to propagate, don't need to go outside, and can govern themselves over with large population. 40,000 people is not a small group of people. It gives us an example of what we can do now if we understood that form of governance, because what they're telling us is either has to be a religious form of governance, it has to be this democratic form of governance, a socialist form of governance, when but all of those are from the people, other cultures, and other moments in time. We have no, we're not able to analyze and look at, well, this is the way, this may have some relevance to our own innate cultural relationship, the way we need to be able to self-govern ourselves. So it's not just a historical thing to make us feel good of what we did in the past. It's lessons and strategies and tactics of what we can do now if they're universal. But if we don't know nothing about it, we can't even explore whether these are alternatives of self-governance in the next.
Exactly. Exactly. In the coming weeks, in the next upcoming weeks, Richard, Brother Omar Wiley told you about the attorneys out of Washington, D.C., right, with the organization talking about colonialism.
Charge colonialism.
Say that again. Go ahead.
Charge colonialism.
Yeah, and they're planning to go to the U.N. In reference to what they're doing. They'll be joining us next week to give our listening audience some details on what is being done and what they're doing as an organization, as a legal entity and a legal organization to deal with our situation here. It's always going to be an interesting conversation, Richard. And it's an interesting conversation with me when we talk to people that are doing something.
Right.
Not people that are sitting by or like they're watching a tennis match, watching the ball go back and forth, and then saying, you should do this, you should do that. These are people that are out here doing something. So we can either join in with what they're doing or start something on our own. But either way, we should be in motion doing something. On February 2nd, 24th, I'm sorry, 2 weeks from now, Sean Rochester, the Black Tax, will be joining us. It should be an interesting conversation with Brother Rochester. He'll be he's scheduled to be on the Time for Awakening program on the 24th of this month. And March 2nd program, Sister Ava Muhammad, A Case for Separation. She'll be sharing with the Time for Awakening audience on March 2nd. So mark your calendars for next week, for March 24th, Sean Rochester and the Black Tax. And for March 2nd, Sister Ava Muhammad. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. I know the thing that they'll soon have to take care of.
Save the children.